You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
This threat is real, but so is our resolve. Americans will not cower, we will prevail. We will defend our country, and we will defeat the evil, twisted ideology of the terrorists.
A man wanted in connection with bombings in New York is now in custody. What's known about him, and was he acting alone? Also ahead, the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, says that he intends to prolong his violent war on drug dealers. And we'll be discussing clashes between Pakistan and India over the disputed Kashmir region. That is all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Monday's Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle, the London-based journalist, and Raffaella Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute. Regular Monocle 24 contributors, both welcome to the programme. Good to have you with us, as always. We begin today in New York City, where a man has been arrested after a bombing attack in New York. A 28-year-old naturalised US citizen from Afghanistan was detained after reports of a shootout with police. His name is Ahmad Khan Rahami. An attack on Saturday in New York's Chelsea neighbourhood injured 29 people. Meanwhile, earlier today, a backpack with five explosive devices was discovered in New Jersey. Raffaella Pantucci, what do we know about Rahami? I guess it's always interesting that we try and piece these things together. A naturalised Afghan, as we understand it. What more do we know? And is it now this process where people begin to start to try and work out what sort of an offender, if indeed he is. Is he a lone wolf? Does he have connections? What do we know at the moment?
Well, at the moment, we know very little, quite frankly. We know his identity. We know the sort of potted bio you provided. I think he's 28 years old. And apparently he's had a run-in with the law in the past. And this run-in seems unclear. There was some dispute about why it actually happened. But he seemed to have some sort of anger against the local authorities, who he said were sort of biased against him because he was Muslim. But we've no real understanding or sense of what that exactly means. At this point, all we really know is that, you know, he is being linked to a series of bombings that now the authorities are all linking together. Mm. Initially, there was some question about whether the New Jersey bomb, the pipe bomb that went off near a race course, the U.S. Marines, U.S. Marine race was about to take place, and then the ones that we saw in downtown Chelsea, and then some more that we saw at a train station. It wasn't clear that they're all linked. Authorities now saying they all come from the same batch. It's all the same devices, and he's increasingly being implicated as the individual who's responsible. But we don't really have any sort of ideology that appears to be driving this yet.
And with your sort of security hat on, do you understand why the media, and I guess for that matter, people in frontline politics who are tasked in some ways with policing this kind of thing, do obsess about trying to calibrate these things and work out, is this a lone wolf? Mm. What are the connections? I mean, it's understandable why that obsession is there, presumably.
Well, yeah, I mean, the idea is people want to know what's happened, you know what I mean? And there's a sort of an urgent need to understand. And, you know, if it turns out it was linked to a wider plot and a network, well, then clearly there's a security failure. How did he get through? What did he actually undertake? And what group is sending a message through this individual? And is it part of a wider thing that we should be fearful of? And you see, the difficulty is, though, if we start galloping down the path of saying it's an ideology and we link it to an individual, we say he's a lone wolf, that he was driven by, you know, this ideology or that one. What if he wasn't? What if he was actually just an angry guy who was, you know, vindictive against the NYPD or against gays or I don't know what? And actually, we're ascribing far more sort of strength and menace to the ideology that he may be sort of linked to than actually it deserves. And so you may end up making it much more of a boogeyman than it really is. So politicians are always desperate to quickly find out and ascribe blame and be able to point your fingers and then make sort of broad political statements. Whereas authority, you know, police tend to be much more, well, hold on. You know, do we really know what we're looking at here? And then we can know, A, exactly how to handle this case, and B, if to worry that there might be others.
Samira, it is interesting, isn't it? We do seem to see a bit of a shifting narrative, though. People now focusing more on this idea, which is a slightly older idea, about homegrown instances of terror, or, you know, whether they're disillusioned people, where it's happened, you know, on the country's doorstep, if you will. And certainly, from what we're seeing, this appears to be a little different than, say, some of the other you know, mass shootings, mass terror instances that we've seen in the United States, here in Europe, of course, over the past months. It does at least outwardly look rather different.
I think what Raffaella was saying is a very important point, that we do risk ascribing too much power to certain ideas by the fact that it takes very little, I think, for an attack to become linked to ISIS, understandably in the political climate we live in. But I think it's also quite pernicious because it does give the impression, which is what ISIS wants to do in encouraging so-called lone wolf attacks, gives the impression of a much wider reach and sort of wider power, and for incidents which might actually be quite disparate into incidents with different motivations. And all it really takes is for someone to write a Facebook status beforehand or call 911 or whatever it is and say, I'm declaring allegiance. And given even that bar is quite low, the fact that we haven't seen that in this case, I think it's important not to rush to conclusions. Obviously, it looks a certain way, but I think it was quite interesting, actually, in the aftermath of this, that there did, at least in the hours following the first explosion, there seemed to be a level of reticence from public officials in New York, which hasn't necessarily happened in other attacks. We've seen it. I think there is a sense in sort of amongst officials, both in the UK and the US, not to immediately say, this is definitely a big terrorist attack and so on. And I think if that trend continues, that's actually really positive, because I think that if we can take a step back for a day or two and just sort of say, what are the facts here? What do we know before we sort of really start getting terrified? Then that's, I think that's a pretty good sort of positive step in how we handle and deal with these as these attacks might be increasing.
And what about the media responsibility? Because I mentioned, politicians are quick to try and establish, you know, patterns of blame. But the media plays this role as well. And they certainly have been... Well, their performance has been mixed, shall we say, in the aftermath of the attacks that we've seen over the last, 12 to 18 months. Do you think there remains a problem, as understandable as it might be, that the media, particularly Western media, and we look to the States here in the UK or France, Germany even, there's a problem that the weighting of their coverage of all acts of terror is obviously biased towards things that they perceive as happening on their own doorstep?
Yeah, I think that inevitably... I mean, I think there's definitely problems with the media handling of these kinds of events. I think it's inevitable that incidents that happen in your own country or closer to home will get more coverage. And so I think that I get a little bit irritated with the kind of virtue signalling that you see quite a lot on sort of Facebook and Twitter and so on, of people saying, oh, well, X number of people were killed in Beirut and that wasn't reported on. Because actually, most of the time it is reported on and people are risking their lives to report on it. It's just that, you know, you don't want to read it. And so it's not on the front pages. So sort of as someone working in foreign reporting, I do find that quite irritating. But I think, you know, while it's inevitable we put more weight on those kinds of incidents that happen either closer to home or in countries that have a more direct impact on ours or and so on, I think there is a problem in the kind of framing, perhaps, which comes back to what we were talking about how public officials and politicians and police and so on respond differently to these kinds of incidents. And I think there's a quite universal urge in all different kinds of reporting to think, okay, what's this? Is this a story about ISIS? Is this a story about X? Is this a story about whatever it is? And sort of to put it in that box and not necessarily look at a case on the basis solely of what's actually happened and the facts we have. There's a tendency to think, okay, well, sort of, can we describe this immediately as an Al-Qaeda attack or an ISIS-linked attack? And then that becomes the line, even if the link is so sort of tenuous that it's literally just someone who has no links actually to any terrorist organisation in any meaningful way, and they've just written a Facebook status before they've gone out and done something horrible. So I think that there's a problem with that, because on the one hand, you need to... I mean, journalism plays a hugely important role, I think, in informing the public and also looking into what the facts of a case are. But done cack-handedly and sort of relying on lazy narratives, it can also just do the exact opposite and sort of play into the terrorising aspect of terrorism.
Well, speaking of lazy narratives, I wanted to ask you, Raffaello, about the domestic political landscape. Does what we've seen over the last couple of days, we're what, mere weeks away from November 8th, of course, the US presidential election. Will we see a change, do you think? We heard a little quote of Hillary talking about these instances at the top of the programme. From Hillary, from Trump, does it necessarily change the dynamic? Does it change the rhetoric? Could it?
I mean, it could. If you were to see a large, successful attack, it would have an impact on the conversation, you know, on the political conversation. I think we've maybe gone past the point that a sort of, Boston-style terrorist attack could have the sort of impact that maybe that you might have seen in the past, in that we've seen so many of those nowadays that it's become sort of, a depressing feature of kind of daily life. And so people don't maybe talk about them as much as we used to see in the past. But if you were to see some sort of a large-scale terrorist attack that was successful in the United States in the next month or in the weeks before the election, and by that I mean quite a short period before, you could see it having a real impact, because they would have to react in a certain way, and whoever was able to establish their sort of credentials, it would just change the sort of mindset that people were looking at when they were choosing to vote, and suddenly put security as a priority, whereas previously maybe they were thinking more about the candidates' personalities, or maybe they're thinking more about the candidates' finances or health, and so it might just refocus people's attention, and that's always very difficult to predict. We've certainly seen other elections in the past that have had explosions near them, which it's had a resonance. We can think back to the Madrid bombings of 2004, which had a very clear impact on the sort of election that happened soon afterwards, though it's a huge political debate in Spain about whether it was correctly handled or not.
All this, of course, happening in New York City and New York State as world leaders gather in Manhattan for a summit focusing on the plight of refugees and migrants. On the agenda, how to humanely deal with the issues affecting the world's 65 million or more displaced people. Samira, it's interesting, and one wonders whether any of this is indeed time to coordinate with all of these leaders and this focus on refugees that's happening in the city at the same time. It could be coincidence, of course. But what is interesting is that attacks or incidents like this, call them what we want, they speak to the kind of pressure that leaders, certainly in the West, are under around a narrative of an open door policy for refugees. We've seen Merkel struggling domestically with it. It's hugely controversial around the world. Do you think that when we see attacks like this, for right or wrong, regardless of the where the culpability for that lies, this impacts on how people view this, the broader question of the migrant crisis?
Yeah, I'm sure it does up to an extent, and that's certainly something that sort of populist and nationalist and right-wing politicians who are in the ascendancy both in America and in Europe will exploit and sort of seek to make those connections between those kinds of incidents. Certainly, I think that's undeniable. What I would like to see is political leadership that doesn't sort of pander to those worst instincts in our political culture and doesn't sort of validate that largely false link, because, it's such a tiny, tiny percentage of incidents.
Is that legitimate? I mean, do you think that there's a reasonable case to be made? Politicians could stick to their guns on that and say, look, I'm not going to change tack in the face of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I think certainly on anything, but particularly on a crisis of the scale that we've got, one, you need strong moral leadership, and you can't have knee-jerk policy making, because it's not, while we do have an exceptionally high number of, I think a record number of refugees and displaced people across the world, that's not a situation that's come about in the last year. That's from years of poor policy making in different parts of the world, and not just conflict, but also very, very much to do with poor policy making. The situation in Europe at the moment, for instance, is not solely because of the Syrian crisis. That's a crisis on Europe's borders that's been building up for a long time, I think. So I think it's a humanitarian crisis. It's not just about sort of showing moral leadership from the developed world. It's also actually pragmatic and self-interested to have a sensible policy on refugees, because that is probably the biggest driver of future unrest, is having millions and millions of people who aren't in education, don't have any employment prospects, can't be integrated properly into the countries where they are. We've got 86% of the world's refugees in the world's poorest countries. And so that's actually more of a time bomb than sensibly resettling larger numbers of people, in my opinion.
Raf, do you go along with that? Because a lot of people are saying, well, look, it's the political reality that domestic pressures on politicians mean that, say, if you had an open door policy or a commitment to an open door policy on refugees, it was necessarily short-lived, because there are opportunists, there are populists who are going to ratchet up the political pressure and make it untenable. Do you think that there are politicians out there who would maybe even be willing to sacrifice their own political interests to a degree to demonstrate the kind of moral leadership that Samira is talking about?
I mean, I think that, you know, politicians at the end of the day would like to get a job done, and they feel they can get a job done if they're in power. So if you're not in power, then you're just a person shouting from the sidelines. And sort of where's your ability to affect the process? So I think that most politicians try to be pragmatic and try to realize that, you know, they're dealing with a situation, a political context that has to be addressed. You know, if you are in a country where the overwhelming majority of the people are voting aggressively for parties that are quite anti-migrant, well, you know, forcing more migrants into that situation or bringing more people in isn't really going to make it any better. It might actually make it even worse. And so, and would that be good for the migrants who are coming in or for the people already there? So I think that they have to try to balance this context. And I think the moral leadership point, though, is an important one nonetheless, notwithstanding this kind of, I think, need for the politicians have to respond to the context in which they're operating. It's still important, but it's important to try to actually do something. I think an awful lot of what we see is just rhetoric where people talk about doing stuff and nothing actually happens. So I think now what we're seeing Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, is going and she's giving a very forceful speech about the fact that, well, why don't we fix things in the countries that these people are trying to come from and try to focus attention on that rather than just sort of leaving our doors open for people to come here. And that's a very difficult message. I mean, it's very difficult, one, to sell that message, and two, to actually implement that. But I think that's where the key really comes in, to actually follow through on some of these statements and to actually try to find out, well, why is it? Or, you know, try to address some of the push factors that are driving people from countries in the first place, rather than simply sort of focusing on the kind of fortress Europe or fortress Britain approach, which ultimately, as we've seen, doesn't really seem to work.
So, Mira, in a word or two then, what chance of anything concrete coming out of this latest summit? Will we hear lots of kind of well-intentioned words again? Are we going to see anything that actually makes a difference to this problem, which is on a huge scale, as you've been describing already?
I'd be very surprised if anything particularly concrete comes out of it. And I think also what we've seen in the past, in recent years, is countries making big commitments about resettlement, which they then don't follow through on. So I think that, I'd be surprised if anything tangible changes from the summit.
A dose of reality, perhaps. This is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. I'm here with Samira Shackle and with Raffaello Pantucci, and we're all back after this.
Monocle's travel guidebooks are just the ticket for anyone who wants to get the best out of a city in just a few days, who wants to go local and off the usual tourist track, who needs good coffee and cosy bars, who likes a retail dash as well as a culture bash. Join us on our global tour. There are now 12 books in the collection, including the latest editions, Singapore, Vienna and Paris. And there are many more books coming your way in the next few months. Track our progress and buy your copies today at monocle.com or at any Wise bookstore. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
This is Midori House, still with me, Raffaella Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and London-based journalist Samira Shackle. Now, Moscow is claiming the United States has broken a fragile ceasefire in the country after mistakenly bombing Syrian government soldiers instead of Islamic State militants. What should we make of this? Raffaello, I guess there's claim and counterclaim when it comes to the US and Moscow, especially over Syria. You know, the idea or the implication here is this is kind of accidentally on purpose. But doesn't all of this and the mudslinging between Moscow and Washington merely highlight precisely how brittle this sort of cessation of hostilities or whatever it's called is and is likely to remain?
I think it also highlights the fact that you can't really be coordinating with someone on the ground who you're not talking to. You know, if you're actually trying to fight a war and a war involves bombs and guns and things that kill people, then you have to be communicating with the people you're purportedly working with, you know. And if you're saying that we're going to work to implement this cessation of fire and we're going to try to focus on fighting the Islamic State, well, you do need to communicate with the people on the ground who you're supposed to be talking to. I think that's kind of the fundamental problem that we're talking about here. I think in terms of the brittleness of this this cessation of conflict in Syria, it was always very fragile. And it wasn't just fragile because the United States and Russia had started, frankly, pointing fingers at each other even before the whole thing had sort of kicked in. But I think it's also because, you know, I don't recall a lot of the groups that were fighting on the ground actually signing up to this deal as well, including a lot of the sort of Salafi jihadi groups that, you know, people are sort of fighting against. So I think that we're not dealing with a situation where we really have all the relevant players around the table yet. And then sort of a subset of that is the fact that now we have this awkward situation where people who are maybe fighting together aren't even talking to each other. And it doesn't surprise me that we're seeing these sorts of terrible things happen on the battlefield.
Tamir, it's interesting, isn't it? We've talked before, I think, on this programme and others about various kind of proxy conflicts that have happened and incredibly turbulent regional disagreements that are rooted in history and so on. But it's hard to recall such a splintered scene where there are so many actors, many, as Raffaello points out, who aren't even sort of at the table when any putative discussions do happen. But where everybody is so distrusting of one another, all the actors here, including the so-called big players, as Raf says, they're not even talking to each other. I mean, is this about as bad as it gets if we look at a sort of a quandary of this scale?
It seems like it. It's so fragmented, and it's a conflict that seems to get more fragmented all the time, and so many different actors, not just local actors, but international actors, and as you've both said, sort of people not talking to each other, not communicating. I think it's quite interesting the way the conversation sort of played out in the US and the UK, actually, that there was a sort of real resistance to intervention, and people talk about intervention in Syria as if it hasn't happened, but actually it's on a huge scale, intervention from many different world powers, but sort of happening potentially against the wrong targets, and it just seems to all be sort of hurtling downwards. And the ceasefire anyway was very difficult to organise. There's already so much bad blood on all sides and accusations going all over the place. So it's very difficult to see any sort of positive outcome at the moment.
Raffaello, easy question for you to wrap this one up. We're doomed to repeat. We're just going to see this weird circularity, claim and counterclaim. Meanwhile, you know, Syria unravels yet further, if that's even possible. Is that the only
I mean, sadly
outcome?
So. Sadly so. I think that's a pretty fair assessment. I mean, if we think back to when Mohammed al-Adnani, the sort of famous spokesman of ISIS, killed the other day, both the United States and Russia both claimed quite categorically that they were the ones who'd actually killed him. So if they can't agree on when they're killing quite prominent ISIS people, we're seeing them now accidentally killing people who are potentially fighting on one side or the other. I think we're still in a situation where the side, you know, the major powers that are sort of involved on the ground aren't really talking to each other at the same level. I mean, it's good that they're talking to each other, which is more than we were seeing before, but I think we're still quite a long way off to see some sort of an agreement which brings to the end of Syria's now, what, 6-year civil war.
Let's go to the Philippines next. The country's new president, Rodrigo Duterte, has called for 6 more months of a hugely controversial campaign against illegal drugs. Thousands of drug dealers and users have been targeted in extrajudicial killings by police and security forces since Duterte took office. Samira, there's an interesting question here. Duterte's hugely popular at home. He's ostensibly doing what the people who returned him to office want. He didn't exactly make any secret on the ticket, and he'd indeed done it when he was a city mayor or so on. He was quite explicit about his conduct in this respect. Do you think that the Western world is mistaken when it's rather judgmental about what he does?
I think kind of human rights conventions and international law and so on exist for a reason. I think we can be quite confident in saying that hugely wide-scale extrajudicial killings are generally a bad thing.
I think
regardless of that, yes, he does have a democratic mandate, and he's sort of known for his colourful language. I think he promised on the campaign trail that he'd kill 100,000 people associated with the drug trade, so he's not making any secret of it, but it's still definitely wrong, I think, because we're not just talking extrajudicial killings by police as well. There's also a lot of killings by vigilantes who are sort of empowered by his call. He's actually called for people to help with killing criminals, and it's definitely not a policy that is easy to support.
This way, a lawful society does not lie.
Yeah, it's not. Inherent in extrajudicial killings is the fact that people aren't going through a due process. And so, you know, you can't. I think he actually said the reason he wanted 6 more months is because I can't kill them all. So it's
worrying.
Astonishing.
Raffaello, are there any precedents for this? I mean, we've seen various presidents in various countries and parts of the world who grant themselves immunity or extend immunity that may already be there. He's been quite explicit, and he said, I will receive immunity in perpetuity for the crime of multiple murder. He said it, and he says it in press conferences and stuff. Are there many others who are as brazen as Duterte seems to be?
There are none that immediately spring to mind. I'm sure he's not the first one because, you know, power crazy leaders is not a novelty to human society. But what I would say is I think it plays more to him as a man. I think him as an individual leader does seem to be upending a lot of sort of previous strategic realities that we all thought held in the Philippines. For example, the close alliance with the United States, which he now seems willing to sort of jettison. The fact that he seems to be willing to talk about buying arms from China and Russia when his country has just been through a very difficult process of arbitration in the courts against the Chinese and claims of their territory. He's pushing back on a number of different sort of fronts and changing sort of the geopolitical or geostrategic realities which seem to underlie the Philippines for some time. So in some ways, putting it against that context, we can see that it kind of fits with him as a kind of a man who's come in and taking this country by its reins and pushing it forwards in his own way. So it does kind of fit within that narrative. I mean, whether this is a wise course of action which is going to lead to a good result, it's very difficult to tell, you know, and I'm not enough of an expert of the Philippines to be able to say how these sorts of stories have played out in the past there. But instinctively, it does feel like he's really trying to upend the apple cart. And, you know, if you're doing it in such a dramatic way with such brazen commentary and statements, I think you're going to start hitting against walls of people's displeasure at some point. And at what point might they push back and actually end up unseating him? I don't know.
But just briefly, we keep talking about populist leaders and, you know, aggressive nationalist rhetoric and leaders who are willing to make quite extraordinary pronouncements that fly in the face of, you know, existing diplomatic relations. Why do we see that? Surely, you know, the value of the ongoing relationship with the US must be worth more. Why would a leader be so ostensibly reckless?
I think that I honestly don't know. I wonder if we have to look at each context in this sort of particular relation. It's possible that he's come into office in the Philippines and said, you know, our situation is untenable, frankly. The Chinese are doing whatever the hell they want. We're not in a situation that we're able to actually affect this. We need to do something new. And this is the something new that we're seeing. I would say globally, I wonder a little bit if it's the fact that, and probably this speaks more to what we've seen in the Western context, is that, you know, if I think back to the last election here in the United Kingdom, where we had basically three leaders running against each other, who are all pretty much of the same kind of background and backdrop, you know, middle class men, white, you know, all been to roughly the same kind of schools, you know, all sounded awfully similar. I think we sort of rushed towards the center has kind of meant that people feel like, well, the current politics isn't answering the questions or the problems of the world today. And so maybe new leaders of the kind of Nigel Farage, of the Donald Trump or the Rodrigo Duterte is necessary to try to change the dynamic and actually make things work in a different direction rather than sort of cruise along on a trajectory which didn't seem to be resolving itself.
Before the end of the programme, let's look to Pakistan. Pakistan's asking the United Nations to pressure India to halt months of violence in the contested area of Kashmir. Samira, we've already talked in the program about various intractable conflicts with you know, years of history behind them. Where are we at in this sort of, I mean, I don't call it a discussion, it's not really, it's a conflict, it's a disagreement, it rumbles on and there are spikes in that. Where are we at the moment that we've seen a day or so ago, rebels attacked an Indian army base there with a number of deaths? How explosive is the situation currently?
It's terrible. I think it's about as bad as it's been in recent years. It's been building for a long time. There's been tensions over this. I was in Pakistan actually earlier this year, and you just sort of hear when you're talking to officials, particularly military officials, a real spike in how much paranoia there is about Indian agents and so on. And I imagine the situation is much the same, if not worse, on the other side of the border, particularly since this this attack by militants who widely thought to be sort of backed, at least covertly, in some sense, by the Pakistani authorities. So you've got a incandescently angry Indian public, Indian government sort of talking big, but probably slightly limited in the steps they can really take against Pakistan. I don't think either side, for all their big talk, particularly want to engage in a conflict that has the capacity to escalate into a nuclear conflict. And it's bad. I mean, the dialogue is more or less non-existent. And interestingly, the US and the UK, who sort of always obviously condemn violence when it flares up in Kashmir, didn't append the normal request for a return to dialogue in their statements on this. And I think that's largely to do with a sort of international frustration with Pakistan, who have been very sort of belligerent and obstructive in Afghanistan, where they also tacitly support, not so tacitly even, militant groups. So I think there's a sort of a sort of acceptance that it's going to be very hard to stop the elements of the Pakistani authorities from supporting these militant groups, and that is really isolating Pakistan, I think, from the international community.
Raf, time incredibly short. In 10 seconds or so, we see Nawaz Sharif has sent letters to the US, Russia, China, Britain, France, asking for intervention. Those are going to fall on deaf ears, presumably.
Yeah, and I mean, if you've got the Indians who are shouting about why aren't people calling Pakistan a terrorist state as the kind of narrative that's coming out of Delhi, I think we need to see Pakistan do a little bit more than that.
Rafaela Pantucci, Samira Shackle, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's programme. It was produced by Rhys James and Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Luke Saunders and Judith Serra, and our studio manager was George McDonough. More music next, 1900, a special edition of Culture. Do stay tuned.